Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Jeff Hayden, your host. 2 years ago, the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, threw out New York's concealed weapon law, a law much like California's, as violative of the Second Amendment, and threw out former President Biden's student debt relief program. We asked our experts, what's next? Last year, the court granted presidential immunities once thought unthinkable, held that the First Amendment prohibits the Colorado Public Accommodation Law from forcing a website designer to design a website for a same-sex wedding, stating it was against her religious beliefs, and found the Constitution's Elections Clause does not vest exclusive and independent authority in state legislatures to set the rules regarding federal elections. Again, we asked our experts, what's next? Needless to say, there's plenty to talk about the last few years, and this year is also replete with activism, politics, and perhaps a few surprises. The court upheld part of the Affordable Care Act that requires insurance plans to cover preventative care, such as cancer screenings, affirmed a Texas law requiring websites with harmful to minors content to verify user ages, despite arguments that it infringed on First Amendment rights, and ruled that parents can opt their children out of school lessons featuring LGBTQ+ themes, asserting the rights to religious objections to certain learning materials. Even in the final week of the Supreme Court term, the court considered President Trump's executive order that purportedly ended birthright citizenship and the nationwide injunction staying its implementation, limiting the power of lower federal courts to issue nationwide injunctions, while also signaling that the administration's attempt to curtail birthright citizenship could be challenged. The decision restricted the ability of judges to apply their rulings broadly to the whole country, rather than just the parties involved in a particular case. Many other consequential decisions were handed down. Some changed existing law, some perhaps not for better. Once again, we find ourselves asking, what's next? Tonight, we have a lot to cover, as once again, this list is lengthy, and in many instances, that list again appears purposeful. We will hear from a trial attorney extraordinaire, and we'll look at the decisions that highlight some of the Supreme Court's latest term, and perhaps take a look forward as we attempt to see what's next. Passions are running high on many of these cases, and we want to hear from you. We want your take on this. If you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And please bear in mind our guests are here to educate and inform you about the legal issues of the day. They can't necessarily give you precise legal advice on your particular cases. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily the opinions of KALW, NPR, the Bar Association of San Francisco, or any of our guests, employers, or clients. But we're here to help inform, educate, give you some guidance. Tonight we have one of my favorite guests, a true lawyer's lawyer, here to help make sense of this constitutional chaos. Having tried cases ranging from antitrust to wire fraud, from patent litigation to white-collar crime and murder, James Brosnahan defended John Philip Walker Lind, the so-called Marin Taliban, an American captured by United States forces as an enemy combatant during the invasion of Afghanistan, and prosecuted Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger for the Iran-Contra affair. Jim Brosnahan is a local legend, Jim is also the author of Justice at Trial, still a must-read, and it hit the newsstands about this time 2 years ago. Without further ado, Jim, welcome back to Your Legal Rights.
Jeff, thanks so much.
You know, before going on to discuss in depth the various cases, can you tell us a little bit about what these cases tell us about the determination of some of these justices and how far are they willing to go in revisiting moderate decisions of past generations and beyond?
I think they're prepared to go pretty far. And whereas I think last time I was on your show, we were still musing about Justice Barrett, for example, and we couldn't tell where she was going to go. Was she a moderate in any way? We were hopeful, I think. There's no reason to be hopeful, and we'll get to that in detail. But this court is prepared to do almost anything presented that will increase the power of the President of the United States. They've already done a great deal, which is the basis for my opinion. But they're prepared to have a person who can sign papers and proceed. So, and he's doing that. I think they're in a musing sort of a thought process on criminal cases, interesting enough. Time permitting, we can mention a couple of those. But I think they're a little actually progressive in the criminal area occasionally. I think that's interesting. They have not had time for civil cases this term. That's really important. They have not had time for state cases. There's only three state cases that are decided this term. And so why is all that? Because the president has put on a full court press, as they say in basketball. And every day he does something, signing a piece of paper, and it becomes his law, and people act on it, and they carry it through. And we'll talk about the court's facilitation of those papers and talk about it. But I think this is now and will continue to be the most conservative court that we have had. More conservative than Berger Court? Yes. Rehnquist Court? Yes. The most conservative.
I'm not sure I entirely agree, but it also depends a lot on how people define conservative. Because a true judicial conservative wouldn't be throwing out these opinions left and right in order to reinvent society from a socially conservative image, which seems to be what they're doing. I don't think we're disagreeing in concept, but I think what they're doing is more activist than certainly judicial conservatism.
If your listeners will forgive me, there's another word I would use, and that's authoritarian. To give enormous power to a president so that he, sitting in the White House, signs papers and the country changes, that's authoritarian in my book. But I don't disagree with your comments.
And I completely agree with authoritarian. Could not basically, I just can't see how to characterize it any differently. We have an all-powerful president who pats his side when he wants Congress to come to his side and basically made them all but irrelevant.
Yes.
Let's talk about some of...
They volunteered.
They did volunteer for the job. Let's talk about some of these cases. The one we spoke of first before taking the air involved the Alien Enemies Act.
Yes.
And for those who aren't listening, this is what the president has cited as authority to suddenly pick up people in the middle of the night and deny them any access to courts or officials and just say, nope, we want you out of here. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the Trump versus JGG case, for example, there are at least two cases in the court this time, has to deal in some way with the Alien Enemies Act, an ancient, antique kind of idea. Last time it was used was in the Civil War, and Lincoln used it. But we were at war, and people knew we were at war. There wasn't any question about it. Here, the war that evidently the president thinks we're in is against a gang. And there may be a large gang, but is that war? That's a question any of your listeners can answer, I think. So the Alien Enemies Act came up, and there were a number of Venezuelans. They were picked up, and they are in the process of being sent. And this case came to the district court. The district court applied an injunction because of a number of reasons and stopped it. Now, this is very important because there have been 44 shadow juries, shadow actions by the Supreme Court in which they take things up kind of out of order. And in this particular case, instead of deciding the Alien Enemies Act, which they could have done by simply holding that it was not likely to succeed. If I ever saw a statute that's not likely to succeed, it's this one. But they ignored that in two cases and sent it back. Now, the effect of this case was to allow the administration to proceed deporting people. And that is central to this term's activities because there were so many of those cases. Here's the picture, very important. The district court, here's the case. The administration has done something, most likely because the president signed a piece of paper. I must admit, Biden did a few of these too. He's not the first one to do it. He's the first one to sit there every day and do it. And so in this case, they stayed the injunction. District court says you can't do it. The Supreme Court stays the stay, which means unless something happens, you can do it.
So the injunction basically said, hold off for now until we sort this out.
Yep.
And the Supreme Court said, nah, go ahead. We'll sort it out on our own time. Just keep doing what you're doing in the meantime.
And of course, the administration has been very aggressive in doing just that, in deporting people.
It's not just deporting people, but it's not letting people have access to the courts, not letting people be heard, not even giving them an opportunity to show they're not the person they're looking for. They just grab them up off the street in the middle of the night.
They also cancel government programs, a number of government programs, on the say-so of the president without consultation with Congress.
So Congress says, we've set up this program, we have money for it over here, and Trump says, no.
Exactly. And they're allowing him to proceed and to do that. And he is very aggressively proceeding to do exactly that. We all witnessed the cancellation of employees. That was enjoined and that was set aside.
And enjoined, of course, for non-lawyers, doesn't mean enjoy, which it sounds real close to. Enjoined means an injunction issues. It's the court saying stop. And the idea is to try to maintain the status quo while we figure out the legality of what's happening.
But around the fringes, the administration has not been obeying existing orders. And that, in my lifetime, is new. I'm not saying it never happened, but I'm saying I have no recollection of it happening. And here it is happening with some bravado and some pride to with attacks on the court from the administration, from high officials in the administration, attacks on the courts. And so the Supreme Court, instead of defending their system of courts, has actually been facilitating the diminution of the powers of the court, which is hard to explain. But here's the key point in the CASA case, which we can discuss a little bit. In that case, district court, actually I think it was three of them, had issued injunctions, and the Supreme Court, instead of dealing with the merits of the problem, and the problem was that the president wrote a government order in which he said people who are citizens, born in the United States, can have their citizenship taken away, and he's got some arguments as to why that's true. That is the dark door of an authoritarian regime. If you can take away existing citizenship, then that's a problem. And
it's been understood for a long, long time that unless you falsified something to get it, once you have citizenship, you're forever a citizen.
Section 1, the 14th Amendment, here's the language which any of your listeners can interpret without further ado. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. What is it we need coming from people who want to empower the president beyond our wildest dreams? That is a question of interpretation there. I don't see that. I don't understand it. Except, and I'd ask your listeners this question, what is the policy that anybody could have in mind to deprive existing citizens of their citizenship? Well, we don't have a lot of discussion on that because it never went to Congress, but it's already in action. The Immigration Service is already beginning to get ready, and unless they're stopped, but they weren't stopped because the court took away a national injunction, which had been a reality for a number of years. And I would say not all the way through, because in the early years, they might not have been national, but they became national a long time ago. What does that mean? It means that if District Judge Jones in Massachusetts finds a violation of the Constitution and enjoins it, that can be a nationwide injunction. Isn't that a good thing if it's unconstitutional? If we can't do that, and they took it away, they held, no, it only applies to Massachusetts. So now Massachusetts will have one law with regard to citizens being deprived of their citizenship. And at the same time in New Hampshire, they might have a different rule.
And one challenge that's been made to these various rulings is that we have activist judges that are looking for cases. For our listeners who don't know, a couple basic points. One is judges don't go out and look for stuff to do. Cases are brought to them. People challenge what's happened to them, and it gets assigned generally at random to a given judge, and that judge makes a ruling. Sometimes when a judge finds that something that's happened is violative of the Constitution, they'll say, wait, you can't do this. That's the injunction. Or wait, let us figure out exactly where the law lies here. And for the time being, keep it status quo. And what the Supreme Court ruled is that it's too burdensome for the administration to have to answer injunctions in different parts of the country. God forbid they should have to have officials travel. So they said, nope, you can only talk about the people that are in front of you. Now, Jim is a scholar of these types of cases for quite a while. I would imagine that they didn't close all doors. There are still some means of getting, maybe not an injunction, but reaching the same result in other ways. Are there not?
Yes, there's class actions. Class actions are brought on behalf of people, and there are national class actions. But I think most would agree it's a cumbersome technique of getting your rights established, and it's not quick. In other words, if you can't stop it, then you're at risk that a number of people will be deprived of their citizenship. But class actions can be used, and it's referred to in the decision as something that, you know, you can work on that. I will say that I really got fascinated with injunctions, and I lectured on it, studied it for a number of years. And what I found was that conservative judges don't like them and progressive judges do like them. And because they're such a good technique to stop something illegal or something unconstitutional, and you need a device to do that. So we have lost something very important.
A listener wrote in and sent me a message. Listener that writes in periodically but doesn't tend to want to be heard on the show directly. But he writes in with a big I told you so, suggesting that Elon Musk really didn't know the risks and dangers he assumed by engaging directly with President Trump and indirectly with folks like Steve Bannon. Now he is threatening to primary the members of the GOP that vote in favor of this bill that's now pending. And the president said he's going to look into his revoking his citizenship and deporting him. Interesting observation in light of our discussion.
Yes. I'm tempted to tell your listeners I don't want to be involved. It's like you're in the third grade. And people who should know better are going after each other now. And they had such a good time firing everybody. As an aside, I got to tell you, I don't know who celebrates firing people. I think a CEO in a corporation who has to fire 4,000 people is probably not happy about it. But in any event, my view of that is that's a train wreck, and there's nothing but good that can come out of it for the progressives of this country, not just watching, but as they trade these back and forth attacks. I'm sorry, but it's delightful.
The problem the progressives have is that it's been some years, 5 years, 6 years, since they had a message other than this president is anti-democratic, and they need to have a more outspoken agenda before they're going to really have their ideas take hold.
But you have put your finger on the worst situation that we have. There were 5 million people demonstrating, and God love them. They're Americans. They have rights, and those rights are being taken away, and they showed us what we ought to do. But there's a silence that has fallen over the Congress, basically, on both sides. And as the Supreme Court is doing all this, there's no effective voice against it of the same quality as the president, who is in five stories in all the papers and on the TV every day. And but I don't want to say there's no hope, because I think there's a lot of hope. People are beginning to understand what happens when the Supreme Court meets. And this idea of a very powerful president has a history that comes from the Federalist Society, which is an organization of very pleasant people who really want a powerful president. And they have supported those ideas. Justices on the Supreme Court, to get back to the court, have spoken there at the Federalist Society meetings and have absorbed the theories of a powerful president, which is contrary to what George Washington wanted. He turned it down. And all that is happening now. So as we go through these cases, you will see time and again the power of the president. Now, in terms of hope and doing something about it, I think that presidential orders should not be allowed, save and except in dire emergencies, not as routine, everyday legal decisions. And but if you're familiar with the Constitution and you watch the news closely, you can see it violated almost on a daily basis. We've not had that before. We've had examples, a Japanese detention during the Second World War, based on race, and we've had our problems, but we haven't had a daily onslaught of orders changing our society and our assumptions.
We've come to view our rights, the roles of our government, vis-a-vis our lives, and within the government, how it functions, in a particular manner. And it seems that that is changing very quickly, and not all for better. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. Now we return to Your Legal Rights with Jeff Hayden here at KALW.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, I'm talking with our guest, trial attorney Jim Brosnahan. We're talking about recent Supreme Court decisions, what might be next on the horizon, both in the High Court's docket and its evolving politics. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number is 415-841-4134. 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And if I haven't mentioned it, remember, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. You want to talk about what the court's doing? You want to talk about some of these states' rights cases we're about to bring up? You want to talk about the role of the president? You can call about anything on topic. You don't have to jump in the same moment we may be in our conversation. I would like to ask you about some of the attacks on the law firms. There are those that have described it as an attack on big law. There are those that have said it sounds like a great idea. You're attacking the wealthy, the powerful. But there's others that see it differently. What they're doing is taking away any of the weaponry for people that don't have power. Talk about some of the cases looking at the attacks on some of these large law firms to try to quiet them or keep them out of federal offices.
The key word is, in my mind, is pro bono. Yes, law firms sometimes run 2,000 lawyers or larger than that. And yes, they very often represent commercial interests. But they also, over the last 40 years, have increased the amount of pro bono that they have done. What is pro bono? Pro bono is for someone who is below the poverty line. These are the excluded in our society. And we hear about them through bar associations, and we represent them, we go to court, and we bring to bear all of the expertise that resides within these large law firms. Some of those cases lead to cases that go to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Again, just for the benefit of listeners, there's more to it being pro bono than just the fact that most of the time you're not being paid anything for it. Pro bono, it's actually pro bono publico, which means for the benefit of the public. And usually you're taking on causes. Maybe you're representing an individual client, but there's more at stake most of the time than just that one person.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And bar associations, including our own in San Francisco, has done a lot to sponsor pro bono cases. I suggested when I was president that every lawyer spend 5% of their time on pro bono cases because the need is enormous. If you go to a court, in a family court, for example, you will immediately see someone who's unrepresented and they need help. They don't know the law and they need help. So that's what pro bono is. And of course, some of those issues are very progressive, and those arguments would go unattended were it not for the pro bono cases. It enriches the law on an equality basis. That's what it does, and that is what Trump attacked.
Silencing critics of his policies.
Absolutely. And some of the firms actually agreed to some kind of an agreement, which in some other day we can get into what was wrong with that. But that's what those attacks are. Well, now, the government didn't immediately appeal the injunction, which stopped it. And that was interesting in itself because maybe they weren't sure that the Supreme Court, this being a very lawyer-like issue, whether the Supreme Court would back him up on that. But now they filed. They just filed an appeal, and they're going to go to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, I think, needs to be, forgive me, very careful about what they do in that case. Because, first of all, law firms don't take dictation from the President of the United States as to what pro bono they're going to do. We don't take it from anybody. We're independent. And that's the key to being a lawyer, any lawyer, small firm, medium-sized, large firm. We are independent. We're outspoken.
The thing for people to remember when we talk of this is that the president isn't talking about the lawyers so much as he's talking about your mouthpiece, your ability to have somebody stand up for you and state your case. And that's what he's taken away because he does not want dissent. Let me take a moment and take this caller. I've got Ann on line one. Ann, you're on Your Legal Rights.
Hi. I wanted to ask, and this just drives me crazy. It's like about immigration courts and why, how are they able to, if these people have complied with the law so far, you know, they've come over, I guess it was through Biden's program that he set up, and they're just abiding by the law and going to their immigration appointments, and then the case gets dismissed in some cases, and then they walk out and they can take them to a detention camp or whatever it is, or they arrest them. And I just don't understand that if they're abiding by the law, doing what they have to do, and if they don't do it, they could be up for deportation.
Can I edit your question just a little bit?
Absolutely.
Everything you said is correct. The piece you left out is that the government goes into those courts and asks the court to dismiss those cases so that the agents waiting outside can simply arrest these people. And
then my next question is, how can they do that? Or why are they doing that?
Well, before you go there,
yeah,
we had an experience last week just here locally where the court declined to dismiss the case because it saw it as meritorious.
Uh-huh.
And these agents of ICE went ahead and arrested the person anyway.
So is that legal?
I'll turn that one over to Jim.
No. No, but I know the Immigration Service. I've had cases against them. I know how they work. They are the least disciplined agency in the federal government. And why is that? Because they deal with the powerless people. They deal with the people that have no lawyer. They deal with people who are in fear for because of their status. But your point is key. A number of those people being deported were here legally. Legally meaning a legal claim for asylum. In my country, I am threatened. If I go back there, I could be killed. And here's my evidence. Here, you want to see the scars? That's the case. Here are scars. I was tortured, and I escaped. And I can't go back there. What you've described is the key question. Is it legal? The answer is no. But it's happening. It's real.
The other thing that is related to this is I understand the Supreme Court basically lifted injunctions of late that would have stopped the president from deporting people to places of the government's choice rather than where people came here from. So somebody comes here from Venezuela, but he's friends with the president in El Salvador, so we'll just park him there.
Right.
In prison.
It's so heinous. It's just awful.
It is awful, and it's meant to be awful. In other words, we being, I include myself with the people we're talking about, we're supposed to be afraid. And that is the central issue in the thinking of our current president. We are supposed to be afraid. Who's the we? Everybody in Congress, Republican, maybe even to some extent Democrats, I suppose.
Anyone who would stand up to him.
Most of the Republicans. Anybody that disagrees with him, any reporter, for example, try to make a list of everybody that he's attacked since he was in his second term. And what is the benefit of having a president who attacks everybody? What is the future of that person? You know, he's not trying to obey the law in answer to your question.
No, he's not. So there's no recourse necessarily. I mean, I don't know if hopefully there will be, but anyway.
The question is how many people are affected in the meantime and how many of the guardrails are destroyed in the meantime. Yeah. There will be recourse, but it may take time. There's going to be a lot of people that get hurt along the way.
Right, and that's his intention, I think.
The problem in talking about this is to give people hope. And what is the hope? American people have been in terrible situations. I was alive when Pearl Harbor was bombed. Mm. And we should never give up hope. Don't give up hope.
I don't give up hope. I'll get out in the streets. He'll get my picture. But
good. The different signs are fantastic.
I love it.
Don't threaten judges, which they've done.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, gosh. And all right. Well, thank you so much. I love this show.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you for joining us in your legal rights, or lack thereof, as the wheel is now turning.
Okay, take you.
I'd like to shift gears a little bit and talk about some of the other issues that have been in front of the Supreme Court of late. One of them, depending on how you phrase it, either has to do with individual rights of LGBTQ+ individuals versus the rights of the state or the parents. I'm talking about the case of Mahmoud versus Taylor. What can you tell us about that?
Well, a couple of things, actually. One, Tennessee had a statute that forbade certain procedures, medical procedures, which were authorized otherwise, although there is controversy in the science about them. I say controversy, but they had enacted this statute that forbade youth from undergoing procedures that had to do with their sex. The President of the United States set the tone for that issue by declaring about 3 or 4 days after he was inaugurated, as though he was standing on a mountain holding a tablet, that there were two genders only. And then he went further and he said that the US government will only recognize two genders. The breadth of that declaration, which he then put into a government order, set the tone for what happened. The Supreme Court said, and Roberts wrote in one opinion, and he said, you know, it's all up to the states. He suddenly went back to states' rights, and they can do whatever they want to do. If the parents complain, I was intrigued by the fact it's the parents. And first of all, I think if you have a child that's thinking that way, and you're a parent, you're trying to do the right thing. But the parents are the ones that can complain, not the child. And some of these kids are, I assume, are in their teens. But here's what's happening there. The administration is setting a tone for the elimination of people in that category. They are setting a tone that those people really shouldn't exist. And those are millions of people. And the president is setting a tone, and the Supreme Court is following it, allowing it, that those folks shouldn't really exist.
And just to be clear, we're not talking about violence to these folks, but rather, the president's view is you're born with a specific given gender, and that's yours for life, no matter what you've done, no matter what you feel, no matter how you look, you are the gender you were born into.
Yep. Well, The government says that. I would just say that. The government is telling us what gender we will be in.
And there's a related issue, though, to that, and that's the case out of Montgomery County, which talked about the books and the stories and the education, and if parents wanted to opt out from their child being in a classroom where they're learning about a different type of folks or folks that define themselves differently, the parent can say, no, I don't like the idea. It violates my religious beliefs. I don't want them there.
I think that's a more difficult issue because of parent control of the kids in school, which has always been an issue. What are they being taught? And personal choice and religious choice. And I'm glad that we've gotten to mention at least the issue of religion in law. And this court is moving, not very slowly, towards establishment of religion, which is forbidden by the First Amendment. So in that case, the question was they want to leave when those things are being shown. There's a big administrative complaint about what that will do for the schools and all of that, but personal choice goes both ways. It ought to. And so that's my reaction to that. That's a more difficult case.
There's another case out of Texas where the Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton, Texas enacted a law which requires certain commercial websites publishing sexually explicit content to verify that the visitors are 18 or older. Nothing really surprising there. And the publishers of these websites said, wait a minute, this violates our right to free speech. So we could really see both sides. One is talking in terms of pure free speech and that it shouldn't be regulated to that extent. The other side is saying, wait, it's not that big of a deal to verify age so that children aren't exposed to these things. What I found rather unusual, and maybe this is a lawyer talking and it might not be as interesting to other folks, is that I've grown up with the idea that any time you're looking at something that relates to a fundamental right, that the court must employ the highest degree of scrutiny to anything that violates that right. And it may well be that they would have ruled the same way had they done so. But they didn't do so here, did they?
No. No, and there's weakness in at least Gorsuch and Thomas in ruminations in other cases about the First Amendment is in need of some redoing, that it's gotten old in some way that requires them to examine our free speech law. In this case specifically that you mentioned is important because they drew a standard that was less than the one that you mentioned. Free speech has been often been protected by a very rigorous standard. If you're going to violate free speech, then you have to meet a very high standard. That protects speech. That's what it does. And in this case, they applied a middling kind of standard, and they thought that, as you say, they decided it that way. I think there's concern here in terms of where are we going. There's concern about the First Amendment. There's great concern about presidential power. There's some concern about religion being used to formulate laws. In a general sense of liberty on the part of people.
Couple more quick cases, maybe don't warrant as much attention, but the court wasn't so big on protecting the First Amendment in the Texas case, yet it seems that the TikTok case, TikTok v. Garland, they made short shrift of it, of they're standing on the First Amendment. Tell us a little about the TikTok case.
Well, the question of standing is used by conservative thinkers to argue that now is not a good time to deal with the underlying important issues that are there. And it's been written about in scholarly journals as to that's the way we can avoid protecting rights. Standing is in the Constitution. To have a case and consider a case, there has to be a real interest on the part of the party. So that's what standing means. TikTok is political. It's got Chinese owners. I use the term loosely, but so do the Chinese. And it has enormous following. And as I'm sure the listeners know, and they don't want to lose it. And the question is, who's going to own it? About 3 days ago, President Trump extended the time for examination of that question. Who's going to own it? Will it be American interests and all of that?
And again, that's one more example where Congress passed a law. President Biden signed it. It was enacted into law. And by law, they had to divest to an American interest or close it down within a certain period of time.
Yep.
President Trump gets elected, and all they had to do was chum me up to him, and he says, we disregard the laws around here. We have a higher purpose.
Well, he thinks that way. He acts that way. He does that way. If you ask me what's the most serious problem from these cases and from the president and the combination between the two, it's reading the Constitution is not necessary as it once was.
Part of this, the possibilities of this, a lot of this would not have been possible but for a perfect storm. Students haven't been taught civics in school for a long time. We haven't been taught the workings of government. Only one side's been talking to pocketbook issues. And whereas the other side was concerned about our democracy, they never talked about how they're going to help put food on the table. And it really enabled someone to walk in without a lot of opposition.
I think that what I found is that people, and you can't blame them, don't know a whole lot about the courts. In a way, we take them for granted when we have a high opinion of the courts. The Supreme Court presently is ranked about 18% favorable. That should tell them something, and that should tell Justice Roberts something. Roberts is the chief. How strong is Roberts? Is he able to focus them in a certain way? And I go back to something I said earlier, which is the courts are under attack here. I mean it literally, with the president standing, or the former president at that time, standing out front, castigating every judge that has anything to do with anything, his criminal case and whatever. But beyond that, he attacks everybody. And the courts are a third department. They're not subservient to the government, except the problem is that is what Barrett says they are. They are subservient in the Cassidy case, and that their job, this is a terrible quote, their job is not to review what the president has done.
And it's never been that way.
That was established by Marbury versus Madison by Justice Marshall a long time ago.
And they've always been the one to interpret the Constitution, decide whether certain actions are lawful or not lawful. The Constitution was always the supreme law of the land. And wasn't that long ago that we had individuals saying, well, it's not a suicide pact. And now the easiest thing to do is to elect a strong man who just disregards it.
I'm interested in the fears of the American people for their own sake. I mean, they have them. And how did we get there? And who is it that will speak their way out of this situation, will give us a vision of hope? Who is that person? I'm waiting for that person.
And while I hate to see this, it may be just the opposite. It may be that we face a common struggle, a common enemy, or a common catastrophe, or something that draws us together. And then we can see our way out of this. We had a glimpse of it on 9/11, but the opportunity was squandered. We need something that will bring us together, make the people more of a cohesive whole, and then to have a vision to go forward.
I think it can happen.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I've enjoyed this great conversation. Our guest tonight, Jim Brosnahan, a local attorney this far short of a legend, is the author of Justice at Trial, a must-read. It's been on the bookstands about 2 years. Please join Your Legal Rights again next week, Wednesday at 6 o'clock, when we take up a discussion of elder abuse in many of its forms. And as always, we'll take your calls and answer your questions. A big thanks to my friend Jim Brosnahan for joining us tonight. It's been most enlightening.
Thank you, Jim.
A little scary at the same time. And especially our thanks to all of you for listening in. And at the controls, Marla Davies. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night, and zealously guard your legal rights. Thank you.